Awesome. How are you guys doing today? Good. My name's Carter. I'm one of the pastors here, especially if you're new with us. I want to say welcome. Glad you're here. Welcome to our 11 o'clock service. Can we give it up for doing our two services? Okay, good. Believe it or not, I think we had more people in our 9:15 service. So thank you guys for holding it down at the 11 o'clock service today. Great. That's going to make room for some new folks. But I hope you guys are looking at this like I do, which is these 2 weeks are really for practice to work out those kinks logistically. And I hope that you're inviting people to the two services for Easter, because we want Easter to be everything that Michael was talking about, so that when you bring somebody in or multiple people in, they have a great experience, but they also hear the gospel very clearly. And so I hope that we're praying toward that end. We're working toward that end. Don't waste the moment. Just like what he said, don't waste the moment. We're trying to equip you guys to be able to invite. So take those inviter cards, take the yard signs, make sure you're doing everything you can to invite people here. Let me just give you the question that I've been asking myself, okay? I'm not putting this on you guys. This is the question I've been asking myself. Is Jesus important enough to me to share him with somebody else? I think that's really helpful for me. I hope that's helpful for you guys. But then I just want to give you a glimpse of our upcoming few months here as we get into more sermon series, just so you know where we're going as well in the next coming weeks. We're going to have next week a guest speaker with us who's going to be a church planting partner. His name's Sam Copeland. He's going to be going to Chicago. We'll talk about that. He'll be preaching. We're going to have an interest meeting right after the second service next week. So I hope that if you are at all thinking about being sent out of this church, whether it's a short-term mission, long-term mission, church planting in the future, what that could look like, you're like, I don't know, maybe come to the interest meeting so we can pitch a little bit of vision for what it looks like to be sent, and so that we can also, you know, hear from Sam and what his vision is more in depth. But it's just 30 minutes after the sermon next week, the second service, and so I hope you guys will be here for that if you're thinking at all about being sent from our church. But then for Easter, we're going to be in Philippians chapter 3, so we're taking a break next week, and we'll get into Philippians chapter 3 for Easter and talk about how Jesus is worth it and living a life for Jesus is worth it. And then following that, we're going to start a new sermon series called DTR, Biblical Relationships. DTR, Define the Relationship. Yeah, I'm trying to be culturally relevant and all that. Okay, so that's why we're doing it. But it will be biblical relationships, friendships, marriage, all the stuff that goes into that. So that'll be really fun. You can look forward to that. Let me take a minute to pray for Easter and then even pray for our time today. But let's ask God to help us in all this. God, we desperately need you when it comes to Easter in particular, just because we know that you want to save thousands upon thousands of people in this Roanoke Valley. And God, we know you want to use all the churches that are preaching your gospel here in this city. But God, we're asking that you would use us. We're preparing the jars for you to do that, God. We want to intentionally partner with you in the mission. We're having two services. We're giving all these inviter things out for tools for people. God, I beg that you would fill up the jars with the miracle of salvation in somebody's life this Easter here at Redemption Church. Bring over 200 people, God, please. Bring people who need to hear the gospel, people who are going to believe that day. God, I beg of you, do that for your namesake, for your glory, and for our joy in the mission. And so, God, help us even today as we go through Philippians and end out our time and end out our series. I pray that you would be glorified through what I say, that you'll help us to understand what your scripture says. God, help me to get out of the way, and please just get into us, Holy Spirit. We just ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. All right, well, today, as I said, we're finishing out our series here in Philippians, our Extremely Ordinary Christianity series. What's extreme to the world is ordinary to us. And so we'll be in Philippians chapter 2, verses 19 through 30, if you want to turn there, find it on your device. And in some ways, I think this series has been really encouraging. You know, the author Paul, he's talked a lot about love and grace and how we ought to live that way, but really, because of what Jesus has done for us, out of his humility and his love and his grace toward us in the gospel. But maybe also, the series has been a little pointed at some times, right? Maybe it's put a finger on a thing or two for us, because he's hammered what it looks like to not just hope for these things, but to live them out, to actually let the grace of God get deep down into our heart and let that drive then how we live our lives, whether we're humble or not, whether we love other people or not, whether we are willing to, you know, argue and complain or not, right? All of these different things he's talked about. But today we'll see almost the culmination of what he's been teaching in two dudes who were with him in his ministry, Timothy and Paul, Timothy and Epaphroditus. So what Paul's going to give us is a picture of success in the Christian life through the example of Timothy and the example of Epaphroditus. He's been talking about all this stuff we should do, and now he's showing us what it's actually going to look like into living examples of people that he's been doing life with and doing ministry with. So here's our main point. If you're taking notes, you want to write this down. Pursuing success looks like pursuing Jesus. Pursuing success looks like pursuing Jesus. That's what these guys' lives are like. So whatever's good in them came from the pursuit of Jesus. And it showed up in how they lived their lives and choices that they made and things that they didn't said. You know, in some ways, Philippians gets us to look at what the mature Christian life does look like. But we're couching this idea of success in that. What does it look like to mature and grow in your faith? Well, what does it look like to be successful as a Christian? So, you know, we could ask the general question, what is success? But I think in the context of Philippians, really what Paul's talking about is the successful Christian life. What does it look like to successfully follow Jesus? You know, we talked about that some last week, legalism or lawlessness. Neither, right? It's somewhere in between. And so success as a Christian looks like Timothy and Epaphroditus. Their lives are successful, Christian lives. What does it look like to live according to God? What is success according to him? And let's just make sure we're clear. Paul said in what we studied last week that God is the one working in us to will and to work, his good purpose. So he's the one doing the work. He's showing us the grace, and out of that grace, then we are able to live by grace continually. We're not going to do it perfect, but he's working in and through us to get us to perfection in eternity. But now, as we live it out, that is the most successful life that we can live. Living out of the grace. That's what success really is. I'm just giving it to you up front, you know? It's not making sure that we have the right car or making sure that we have the right career or the right house or that we appear a certain way on social media to the right people. It's not any of that American dream stuff. That's all dung, Paul says in chapter 3, if you'll recall. It's not even being the best father or husband that I can be. It's not even being the best mother or wife that you could be or the best friend that you could be or something like that, although those may come from a successful life. Do you see where I'm going with that? They may be results of a successful life, but the successful life, pursuing success, looks like pursuing Jesus first, above all, because he is the embodiment of true success, and he enables our success by giving us his own. He redefines what success is for us. I think that might be one reason why I ended up pursuing seminary instead of architecture coming out of my college career, for example. I'm just giving you one example of this, because when I was at Virginia Tech in the architecture program, the teachers were trying to get us to give our lives over to architecture. If we wanted to be successful, it meant long hours in the studio. It meant working all the time. It meant waking, every waking moment of our lives was devoted to honing our craft. That's true success in the world's eyes. And I think it's like that in most disciplines, right? And so maybe perhaps in one of the rare moments that I actually did something to follow God and believe his grace in college, okay, I remember just rejecting that outright and saying, that's not true. I'm not going to pursue architecture. I'm going to pursue Jesus. I'd just come back to my faith. God was pursuing me, and now he was teaching me to pursue him, and I couldn't pursue something else in his place. Like I came to a realization by his grace, no doubt, that I needed to pursue him. I wasn't going to work 18 or 20 or 24-hour days to get the project done. I was going to take lower grades, and I did, because I wasn't willing to put in the hours. I mean, they were impossible. Generally, they wanted you there all the time, and I just couldn't do it. And I remember having a conversation with one of my professors, maybe along these lines on what true greatness is. He's the one that brought it up, not me, okay? So he brought it up. He was trying to persuade me that I need to put the effort in, put the time in, pursue greatness, pursue success. And so I took the opportunity to share the gospel with him. And I said, well, listen, man, I think true greatness, according to the Bible, is going after Jesus, because he's the embodiment of true greatness and true success. It's self-sacrifice. It's making yourself low and serving others. And it's embodying all of his characteristics and all of that. And of course, my professor, I mean, you know, he loved that, right? So, I mean, my professors loved me in college, I'm sure. But he was just like, you know, I can't talk to this guy. I can't teach him anything. But I just wasn't buying what they were selling. I just wasn't going to do it. Thank God, by his grace. Because to pursue success doesn't look like pursuing our career, or anything else like that. Pursuing success looks like pursuing Jesus first and nothing else. He is primary. And that's why we see Paul saying what he does here in the text with Timothy and Epaphroditus. We see him getting there. He's holding them up and commending them to the Philippians and to us as examples of men that we can look at and look into their lives and want to be like and follow and see how to live it out. So I want to go ahead and read this chapter for us, the rest of the chapter here, starting in verse 19. I'm going to make four big observations on what the successful Christian life looks like according to Paul here. It's not comprehensive, it's not all-inclusive, but he gives us four principles to look at in their lives, probably more. I could probably give more, but I'm going to focus on four things that we can see here, and then we'll try to apply it very quickly at the end. But let me read what Paul wrote in verse 19. This is what he said. Now I hope in the Lord Jesus to send Timothy to you soon so that I too may be encouraged by news about you. For I have no one else like-minded who will genuinely care about your interests. All seek their own interests, not those of Jesus Christ. But you know his proven character, because he has served with me in the gospel ministry like a son with a father. Therefore I hope to send him as soon as I see how things go with me. I'm confident in the Lord that I myself will also come soon. But I considered it necessary to send you Epaphroditus, my brother, co-worker, and fellow soldier, as well as your messenger and minister to my need, since he has been longing for all of you and was distressed because you heard that he was sick. Indeed, he was so sick that he nearly died. However, God had mercy on him, and not only on him, but also on me, so that I would not have sorrow upon sorrow. For this reason, I am very eager to send him so that you may rejoice again when you see him, and I may be less anxious. again, Paul's just talking about his grace. Like he may be less anxious about them being anxious, right? He's just showering them with love and grace and care in verse 29. Therefore, welcome him in the Lord with great joy and hold people like him in honor, because he came close to death for the work of Christ, risking his life to make up what was lacking in your ministry to me. Again, not a dig by Paul at all, but just saying what you weren't able to continue to minister to me, and he came and did. He finished that, in other words. So throughout this section, Paul just both commends Timothy and Epaphroditus and gives a bit of a travelogue for himself, what his hopes are and what he believes God's going to allow him to do. And eventually, he hopes to come to the Philippians, and he does later on, according to what we know about history. He's able to go back to them at least one more time before he's put in jail again and then, you know, kept there and die there. But, you know, we don't know that for sure. He hopes to come to them. But in the meantime, he's going to send Epaphroditus now with the letter that they're reading. And then he's going to send Timothy a little later on so that he can get a clear picture of how they're doing spiritually so that Timothy can report back to him, maybe assuming that how they respond to this letter even. Like, are they going to even respond to the letter that I'm sending? And Paul's commending Timothy in some ways here, reminding them of his own care for the Philippians, and in sending Timothy, his own care, Paul's care, but then also of Timothy's care for them as well. So we see him say a few things, two that I'm going to point out with Timothy, his genuine care, his proven character. Verse 20 says, "For I have no one else like-minded who will genuinely care about your interests. All seek their own interests, not those of Jesus Christ." So the first thing I want to highlight is Timothy's genuine care. His genuine care. This is a characteristic of a successful Christian life. We're trying to summarize everything Paul's been saying here. Genuine care is a word that he uses. And he was telling them that Timothy is like-minded with him, or the literal translation is like-souled. So basically, they're just two peas in a pod, him and Timothy. They're just like the same guy, you know? They just love each other. They love the Philippians. They're all about the mission. God's mission is their mission, all of those things. And so Timothy, like Paul, deeply cares about the Philippian church and their spiritual maturity and growth. He wants them to grow. So Paul uses the same language he used in chapter 2, verse 4, that Timothy doesn't seek his own interests, but theirs above his own. He sees them as more important than himself. That's genuine care for somebody else. You're willing to put their needs before your own needs. So again, really, that's humility as well, as Paul's been talking about here. He's saying that humility is part of genuinely caring for other people. And I've said this before, but I think it's relevant here and good to write down. Humility isn't thinking less of yourself. It's not devaluing yourself, but it is thinking of yourself less. Like you stop worrying about your own needs as much. You stop worrying about what your comfort and convenience looks like and all of those things, and you start putting the needs of others before your needs. Paul's willing to give up Timothy's encouragement for a time so that the Philippians could experience Timothy's encouragement, right? He's willing to give that up and put their needs before his own. Timothy, the same thing. He's willing to go and be an encourager and give up some things to be there with the Philippians. Genuine care. Many of us probably would have thought of all the reasons why, you know, we shouldn't or couldn't go on something like this in these moments. Like, well, man, I'm busy, I've got this, I've got that, I can't do this, I can't do that. But Timothy seems like he's the kind of guy that would have thought of reasons why, you know, he should. And he probably would have asked that question, not should I go, but why shouldn't I go? What's holding me back from encouraging other believers when they're in need? And to give his point more weight here, Paul contrasts Timothy's genuineness with those who might be seeking their own interests. And so they're not seeking the interest of the Philippians. They're seeking their own personal interests. And so he's contrasting that. Timothy's not like that, but these other people might be. The wording's a little weird in verse 21, I think. But what he's talking about here is that other people in Rome around him, or really probably more likely other people in Philippi around the Philippian church, they're religious legalists. And they're sowing division in the church. And they're not genuine. They don't care about the good of the Philippian church. They care about their own good. These are the Judaizers who are trying to add rules onto the grace of faith. Right? The Christian faith comes in and says, no, it's just you're saved by grace through faith. And the Judaizers come in and say, that's great, but you also have to be a Jew. You also have to do these things. You have to get circumcised. You have to follow the Ten Commandments in a specific way. You have to go through these religious rituals and all of that. And Paul's saying, no, that's not genuine care. That's not at all what this looks like. Those people care about their own interests. He's implicitly warning them to watch out for that. He's saying, don't you be like that, and don't let other people like that influence you and show you. They don't genuinely care about you, and that's tricky to spot. It really is, because usually like the Judaizers, they were really slick about it. Yeah, the grace is great, the grace is good, but also you got to do X, Y, or Z. They cared about, when you really got down to the bottom of it, not people and their spiritual maturity, but they cared about doing what was right and being right. I mean, at the end of the day, their zeal was present. That's what makes it so tricky. They were passionate. But they were passionate about making sure that people followed the right rules and did the right things. They weren't passionate about people growing into the grace that God had for them. So those people might appear genuine at first, but do they really care about others? Do they really care more about themselves and how they appear to others? These are all things that we've talked about throughout the sermon series. People can't say that they're for you and then do different things with their actions. They can say that they're for you all they want, but if their actions show differently, that they're for themselves, it'll become very apparent. They have to prove with their actions over time that their character is in the right spot. And so Paul says in verse 22 about Timothy, but you know his proven character, because he's served with me in the gospel ministry like a son with a father. He has proven character. So you can write that down as the second point here, proven character. He genuinely cares, and he's proved it by how he talks to you, how he acts around you, what he's trying to do in your life. He's trustworthy. He has integrity. He's gentle and peaceable, so he's not, you know, prone to complaining or arguing, as Paul said last week. He's a guy that wants unity, and he's willing to fight for that, whatever it takes. He's a guy who is for God's mission and how he lives out his life, which means he's for people because people are the mission. So he's probably a guy that you might just want to be around. You know, no matter what his personality is, he's just a guy that you want to learn from, that you see something different in his life, and you say, I want to be like that. I want to get around this guy. Basically, he fulfills 1 Timothy 3, the letter that Paul would write to Timothy later on about who elders should be and what they should look like. You might remember that passage we studied a few years ago as a church. You can look back up. But it's geared toward elders, and yet it really just describes the life of a growing, maturing believer, period. Like these different characteristics are things that all Christians should grow into. Certainly, he's not saying Timothy's perfect in any of these characteristics. Nobody is. But he's living out of the grace and into that grace that God has worked into him. And he's doing it with consistency. He's doing it in proving his character. He's aligning with the grace that God has worked into him, and it shows in how he's living his life. Incidentally, I think it's one reason why Paul likely says not to allow new converts to become elders in a church. Because, for example, I mean, that spiritual leadership and that level of leadership can make them conceited, and they can fall into pride because they can think they're more mature than they really are in their faith, and that causes their downfall. They need to have proven themselves over time. They need a proven track record of good character and how they love and serve other people in the church and how they handle conflict and argument and all that kind of stuff. That's why for us, when we appoint elders in the future, we have three right now, but when we appoint more as we have need, we're going to put them through a 9 to 12 month process to make sure that they're someone that we as elders and then you as the congregation can look in and say, yeah, they're proven character. They have proven character. Yes, I see that. Or, nah, I don't think I see eldership in them yet. I don't think they're there yet. And so we go through that process to be able to see it. They need to prove it. They got to be able to prove their character over time. Will they serve our church or will they just serve themselves and their own needs? There's obviously way more we could say about all that, but I want to keep going here because Paul turns to Epaphroditus next in verse 25 and he says, but I considered it necessary to send you Epaphroditus, my brother, co-worker, fellow soldier, as well as your messenger and minister to my need. So he was sent by the Philippian church to Paul to minister to him while he was in Rome in prison. So we don't know what he brought to Paul or what he did for Paul to encourage him, but we clearly see that Paul was encouraged. That's why he was sent, to be an encouragement to that. That's why we send short-term teams over to our missionaries that we're going to send, like with Adrian and Rachel over in South Asia. We're going to send a short-term team. Why? Well, I mean, we'll be able to help with some of the work for 10 days, but there's only so much you can do in 10 days, right? A lot of it's just an encouragement, too. We want to go over and encourage the missionaries and the church planters and all of these people that we send out. So we want to be an encouragement like Epaphroditus. He was that to Paul. And in doing so, he almost died. I think there are probably some people been on short-term mission trips to some third world countries that may also have felt the same way, depending on their food situation, right? We've heard some stories about that. I don't know. Some of y'all have lived it, okay? I see you. So I know. You might have felt like you're going to die. But Paul is saying he almost died, and because of that, he risked his life. He's worthy of honor. He's worthy of honor for doing that and being willing to give of himself. And then he's, Paul sending him back to the Philippians with this letter in hand so that Paul can communicate to the Philippians. Paul said several things about him, like Timothy, but I'm just going to give you two again, and they're going to overlap some, but you can see what this success looks like. You can write this next one down, ongoing consistency. Consistency. Paul's basically commending Epaphroditus for his consistency in the mission and what he believes. He's living what he says. He says he believes something, and he's living it out. In reality, he's consistent. And he's consistently working to build others up in the process of that and live it out in a real and tangible way with other believers. Just think about what it means to be a brother or a co-worker or a fellow soldier. These are all very personal things, good illustrations for Paul. He loves using this kind of language, right? When you think about a brother, for example, in your family, somebody that's your sibling, you want to be around those people. You love those people. He said in verse 26, he longed to be with his church family again. There's a brotherly love that's there. I heard one pastor say this, and you can write it down. I think it's really good. We never grow beyond our need for others. We've always got to have people speaking into our lives. We always got to have people around us in our lives. That consistency. I don't have siblings. I've told you that before. I'm an only child. My wife's an only child. But our kids do have siblings. You know, we have three kids. And so we've gotten to watch what it looks like for them to live as a family and have that kind of relationship. It's really cool. And every once in a while, Mimi and Papa will take one at a time and have them stay over and pour into one at a time. I think it's a really special thing, really good for them as they grow up. And the last time that we had Evelyn go, and she stayed with Mimi and Papa, man, I can't tell you, but Guinevere was beside herself. She didn't know what to do. I mean, when's the last time she was ever without her Wawa, is what she calls her. It's really sweet. When was she ever without Evelyn? She cried. She was upset. She's like, I don't know what to do with my life. My sister's not here, right? Like, there's that consistency. Right? She's around her all the time. She loves her. She's her best friend. All of those kinds of things. Very few moments when she's not around her sister. Paul's communicating that kind of consistency here with these guys, especially Epaphroditus. There's a need for others to be around others, to do life with others. They were there for one another. They included one another rather than excluded one another. When nobody else was for them, they were for each other. And it's not like that in our culture. That just walks away when it gets hard and cancels and all of that kind of stuff. And man, it takes so much humility and so much patience and so much love and consistency in order to be able to live that way. But there's also a question of availability in it as well. Like, are you just available? Are you making yourself available to live that way? So you can consider this question this week. Are we making ourselves available for one another? Are you doing that? Are you consistent in being around one another? That's why we have the structures that we have at our church. You know, I mean, people always think that it's self-serving for a church to say, well, get plugged into our structure. Listen, we exist to serve you. And the structures we have are to help you grow and mature in your faith. And the reason we make a big push for something like community and DNA groups is because we know it's going to help you. That's why we do it. We don't do it just for fun. I don't know. We do it for you guys to grow. So that you can foster this consistency and availability for yourself. You got to make yourself available, though. You got to be willing to be around other believers on a consistent, regular basis. I know it's not always easy, especially depending on your life stage and what's going on, but are you using the availability you have in order to labor alongside other brothers and sisters in the faith, other soldiers, other co-workers? Availability takes margin of our time and a willingness to serve the needs of others before our own. But that's why it's so encouraging when I see people jump in to help others here at our church. I love the culture that we have. People, man, getting around others and doing a meal train for when they have a baby, or getting around and helping people move when they need help, or whatever the case might be. Childcare, all of these different things I see all over our church center app, you know, the community that we have there. If you're not on that, you can talk to somebody about jumping on it. But I love seeing that in our church, and I think we fostered that culture really well. But I also think it's worth asking, do you serve others outside the church? Well, are you making yourself available for outside the church, those outside the church? Are you inviting non-believers into your life so that they can see how you live, but then you can listen to their needs and serve them sacrificially and share the gospel with them? I'm just thinking about the bless model that we've talked about in our church. Are you able to bless people in that way? Yeah, sometimes that'll mean meeting physical needs, for sure. But oftentimes, I think in the context of Philippians, the more important thing is you need to meet their spiritual need to know Jesus. That's their need. You got to be willing to meet that. You got to give margin. You got to make yourself available, be consistent in all of that. And before I move on, I think what you might hear when I say things like that is, well, I guess I got to start serving at the pregnancy center then. Got to make myself more available. I got to add one more thing. You know, I got to go serve at the least of these or something like that. And I'm like, okay, there's a heart issue if that's where we're at, right? don't do that. I mean, if you're available to do it, go for it. Like if you got availability and you're convicted and you know you need to give up some of your time to do those things, then go for it, please. But I think really what we're looking at is our heart in this, and we're looking at how everything in our life becomes a way to serve others' main spiritual need of knowing Jesus, which probably means how you interact with people on a daily basis, which probably means specifically for most of us in this room, how you do your job on a regular basis, right? You consistently go to your job every day, don't you? If you don't, there's a problem, you get fired and all of that. So if you spend most of your waking hours doing that, how does that become a way that you're consistently pouring into other people and meeting their greatest need? How are you serving others through that? That's the mentality here. It's not that we just start to section off our life and think, well, I've got to serve this way, I've got to be this way, I've got to go over here and help this, and we section everything off. No, no, no. Everything works together to follow Jesus, including how you think about your job and how you serve through your job. It's a mindset change. Your job is that thing that God has gifted you in and is using you in. Are you pursuing Jesus to serve others through it, not in spite of it? Don't miss that today. That's ongoing consistency. There's a lot more there. But finally, something we see Epaphroditus show here that Paul points out is unwavering courage. And that's the final thing that we'll write down for today with regards to the success, the four big things here, the four points of success. And we've already talked about courage some, so I won't belabor it too much. But Paul commends Epaphroditus and says in verse 29, he's someone to be honored because he risked his life for the sake of the gospel. And he was willing to risk his life and even die for the mission. Fight alongside his fellow soldiers. That's why he says soldier, right? Soldiers are willing to go into the battle and do anything it takes to win, including giving their own lives. That's unwavering courage. Man, I've talked about Richard and Sabina Wormbrand before, but their story just haunts me. And I hope in a good way to remind me of what God really wants out of our lives. Because if you'll remember their story, it wasn't just Richard willing to risk his own life and his family's well-being for the sake of the gospel. It was also Sabina. And it was eventually then their son, Mikhail, or Michael in their, you know, in our language. But they were willing to risk it all. Because if you remember his story at all, you know that he went to jail during Nazi Germany's reign over Romania, that's where he's from, and also through communist Russia's takeover. And he said the communists were way worse, because they would torture them, and they would keep them, and they would play psychological games with them. And in one, I think it might have been in his second stint in prison. He was there for years, and his wife and son really just had to kind of keep up with people and try to hear where he might be, what prison he was in. Because when you got arrested, you were just snatched right off the street, right? Like there's no, oh, well, he's in such and such place. You had no idea. One day your loved one just didn't come home. And he was preaching the gospel, and he was a pastor over church there, and they arrested him. He was gone. And so Sabina was raising Mikhail herself, their young son. And then one day she was snatched up. She spent 3 years in prison. What happened to her son? He just came home one day, and she wasn't there. And he knew when she didn't show up that she must have been arrested. So he went over to one of their church members' homes, and he lived with that church member for 3 years. While she was in jail. Can you imagine that? That kind of sacrifice, that unwavering courage is what God calls all of us to. Now, we might not be in a communist regime, but what are you doing to live out that courage? Are you living in a courageous way where you're at? What does it look like for you to do that here? Can you imagine giving up your entire family structure and your comfort and convenience for the sake of the gospel going forward? They did. Haunts me. What are you willing to risk your life for? What kind of success do you deem worthy? Is it the mission? Unwavering courage means you have other believers back in the spiritual battles that you're in. It means you're going to go forward no matter what. It means you're working shoulder to shoulder with the same mind, same purpose, same everything. Like that unity that Paul's been talking about, all of that, to ultimately live on mission for God and advance his kingdom no matter what comes. And yeah, it'll cost us some convenience and some comfort. It'll even cost us some relationships. You know, gospel goodbyes are really hard, but Paul did that with both Epaphroditus and Timothy here, didn't he? He sent them away. He sent them out. That's hard. You don't want to have to say goodbye to people that you love. But as a church, I hope that we can ask God to give us that same kind of courage to be able to do whatever it takes to get the gospel to our neighbors around us. Of course, the problem is we're never successful enough and we'll never have those kind of characteristics and we'll never feel that way fully in our lives. We're never successful enough in any of these ways. You might look at the four characteristics and go back over them and think, man, that's impossible. There's just no way I'm going to have that kind of character or that kind of courage or whatever the case is. And you know, you look in that's the right response. You're not. You never will. None of us will. We're never going to be successful enough. We'll always default to selfishness. We will never genuinely care for people enough. We'll always genuinely care for ourselves, though, right? We'll never prove our character enough, but we'll prove our selfishness over time. We'll never, you know, have this consistent desire for unity, for the mission, but we will have a consistent desire to put ourselves first. And we're not going to always have unwavering courage, but we certainly will always have unwavering fear and cowardice in our lives. Even when we try to define success for ourselves, listen, you might be here and you might think, oh, I'm not that religious. I don't really buy into all of that. That's fine. But when you try to define success for yourself, you'll always fail. You'll never live up to the standard that you set for yourself. You'll always fall short every single time. We'll never get enough money. There's never enough money in the world that you can get. There's never enough admiration from others that you can receive. There's never enough stuff that you can obtain to make yourself successful enough to satisfy. I mean, we'll never even follow enough rules or even love and care and serve others enough to make ourselves feel successful. I mean, I think about Steve Jobs is just a great example of this. You know, he died not knowing whether, you know, God existed. He said, I wish I'd written down the quote, but I thought of it later after I'd printed out my notes. So I jotted some notes down. So this isn't verbatim, but he basically said, I'm 50-50 on whether or not, you know, I believe in God. He said, but what I do want to believe is that something endures. I want to believe that something lasts. I want to believe the wisdom that I've accumulated or the knowledge that I've gained over time, I want to believe that those things will endure past when I die. Well, he tapped into a basic human desire that we all have. To be successful and truly be successful and what it means to be successful, because we're never good enough and we all know that. We all inherently recognize that because the standard is perfection and none of us can reach it. But that's why God sent Jesus into the world for us, because he was perfect on our behalf. That's the good news, right? That's the good news right there. Jesus lived the perfectly successful life for us. That's the gospel. He did that not just at risk to his life, but he gave his life up so that we could attain the success that he purchased on our behalf. He's the better Timothy. He's the better Epaphroditus. He's the better us. We can never be successful. He was. He was the perfectly successful person. And everybody feels guilty for something. Everybody feels restless for something. The bottom of their heart, they know they can never be perfect in that way. And what we need is him to apply his perfection to us. Jesus was perfectly genuine and caring for everyone, including you and me. He proved his character over time by living the perfect life that we should but don't. And he was completely consistent in how he served us. And he was unwaveringly courageous enough to die a death on a Roman cross. And then unlike any of us, though, he was powerful enough to raise himself from the dead. And when he overcame death, that enabled us to have his perfect life applied for us now and into eternity. So when God sees us, he sees Jesus' perfect success, not our brokenness, not our imperfection, not our failures. He offers us success when we place our faith in him, so that when God looks at us and we're in Christ, he sees Jesus. So for us, pursuing success is continually pursuing Jesus. That is success, pursuing Jesus. It's not the list of things that we can do for ourselves. It's the list of things he's done for us in our place and then applied to our lives through nothing that we've done. We don't deserve it. But he's done it anyway because he loves us. So if you want to live that successful life, what you need to do is start by repenting. You can write that down as an application point for yourself today, because that is the starting point for success. If you want to be successful and pursue Jesus, you got to start with recognizing that you're not successful and never will be enough, that you're not perfect, that you failed in multiple ways, morally, all of these different ways in your life, and then you let him work in you. Repenting is going to Jesus and saying, I'm sorry, I know that I am not perfect, but I know that you were perfect for me. I believe you, and I want to follow you with my life. If you haven't put your faith in him today, man, I'd really encourage you to do that now before you leave. There is no reason for you not to. And if there are barriers for you, I would love to talk to you about that. Because I had barriers too. I came back to the faith in college. I wrestled with all this stuff. Why do I believe what I believe? All of these different things. If there are barriers, I would love to speak to you. One of our elders, one of our leaders, our prayer counselors down front here can help you with some of that. But if you need to repent again today, which is all of us, by the way, we all need to repent over something, right? Take time to do that as we respond together here in just a minute. Because when you humble yourself before God's authority and make yourself low, James 4 tells us he will lift you up. He's the one that puts you up on a pedestal in a high place. And there's nothing more successful than that. We're successful in God's eyes because of what Jesus has done on our behalf. And that brings joy. And that's what Paul has talked about all throughout these two chapters that I haven't really touched on that much over the last 6 weeks. But I just want to make sure that I emphasize, maybe even as I close out our sermon series here for today, following Jesus and pursuing him leads to joy. That's what true success will lead to. True success, pursuing Jesus, looking like him, it leads to joy, both now and into eternity. That's the whole point that Paul's making. Everything that he does, he's like, man, you know what? I'm suffering, but I rejoice. You know what? I got people preaching against me out of rivalry or envy, but I rejoice. You know what? I'm in jail, but I rejoice. You know what? I got to send Timothy and Epaphroditus away from me, but I rejoice. He rejoices. How does he do all of that? That's the successful Christian life in action. Because he knows the grace that he's been given and he's able to live out of that grace and he just rejoices at it because God is working in him and through him in a supernatural way. He gets to experience that and it brings joy in his life. And guys, that's what I'm telling you is going to happen this season, this Easter season even, if you invite somebody to church and they become a Jesus follower because you did that. Can you imagine the inexpressible joy when you see somebody go from restless to redemption in a very real way? It's going to be so awesome to see that. Don't you want that for somebody in your life? I know I do. And it's not possible apart from Christ working in us either. But by grace, all of these four things and more are ours. If we put our trust in him and let him work, if we surrender like we sang in that second song today, if we just surrender and let God work through us, then it's possible by grace. So the only thing that I want to end with here and just give you two questions to really consider, again, just maybe wrapping up our entire sermon series since that's what we're doing today. I want to ask you these two questions and let you reflect on these this week. You might want to write them down and think about them. Are you allowing others to invest in you? And are you serving and investing in others? Really good thing for you to think about. Really good thing to wrestle with. Are you allowing others to invest in you? Are you in community group on a regular basis? Are you committed to being here on a regular basis and being around other believers? Are you committed to just investing in other people's lives, letting them invest in you? You know, if somebody in our church, really, especially somebody that you trust, speaks into your life, are you willing to listen to them? You're going to allow people to pour into you in that way. But then also, are you going to be willing to do that for somebody else? Are you going to be willing to speak into their lives? Are you going to be willing to serve and invest in them? Are you going to be willing to be consistent and available to them? Are you going to do God's mission together, side by side with somebody? Because remember, people are the mission, and that's what we're all about here. So I hope that you'll invest in somebody else this week. And again, the very low bar for us guys is to invite them to Easter. God's just given us some of these things in our culture today. One of the most effective ways to share the gospel with somebody in our culture can be to invite them to an Easter service and then talk about the gospel afterward. I'm going to give them a very clear gospel message here. You guys will have the opportunity to follow up and ask them what they think about that and what they're going to do with Jesus. Man, I hope that you will take that opportunity. Everybody's trying to pursue success in their own eyes, everybody. But we know, because of what God's done in us, that pursuing success looks like pursuing Jesus. So let's invite others into that with us this week. Let me pray. God, thanks so much for listening with us today. We hope that it was an encouragement to you. But you know, we don't see this as a replacement for gathering with other believers in a local church context. So if you don't have a local church, we would encourage you to plug in with one wherever you are. And if you're in Roanoke, Virginia, we'd love to invite you to plug in with us here at Redemption Church. And you're welcome anytime to gather with us, but you can check us out online at our website, redemptionroanoke.com. You can look for other content or resources there. But thanks again for listening.